The decision to come here in USA was taken by all family or what?
Well, the decision was that being not too many years after the war, we were still economically we were in need of things, economically speaking. So we decided that, and of course, in those days, the rage was that all young men went out and looked for work, since there wasn't any work in the area. Some went to Canada, some went to Australia, South America. So I said, you know what? That probably would be my way out to get a decent job somewhere else besides at home, even though I had a job, but I wasn't paying that well.
You told me your older sister,
Vilma,
wasn't still employed in the United States in Boston.
Well, my sister Vilma was working for an Italian consulate in, I believe it was Milano. I'm not sure if it was Milano or Trieste, but I think it was Milano. And this consulate had an appointment in Boston, Massachusetts, in 1950. So my sister went along with this family. To what position that she had into his doing, I'm not really sure. But she went along with them, and she lived in Boston for 2 years until his tenure was over. He had to go back to Italy. So my sister elected to go back, even though she could probably applied to stay in the United States, but she decided to go back. And so she went back in 1952, right after I came in this country.
Can you tell me something about the journey? You have the ticket.
Well, this ticket represents my ticket into this country. Aboard of a ship called Argentina. Of course, after I made my papers to come into the United States, I knew that I had to have money enough to pay for the passage, and I didn't have the money to pay for the passage. So I said, what do we do? We needed 100,000 liras. Well, I had an aunt that immigrated to Canada in a few years before I came here, because her husband was in Canada. She joined him there. And so we felt that she had the means to borrow the money from. So I wrote my aunt, and I says, aunt, I said, I'm ready to leave for the United States, but I need the money for the passage on the ship. And I don't have the money. I says, could I borrow the money from you, and I'll return it to you when I get there, when I get a job? And she went along with it. She said, okay, I'll send you the money. So she did. And we were able to pay for the passage. My mother accompanied me to Genoa on a shoestring, because we had no money either, for the train ride. As a matter of fact, the train ride went through Como, where I had another aunt, my father's sister, and my mother had to borrow the money from my aunt to return back to San Quirino on the train. And I left. My mother took me to Genoa. I boarded the ship, and I remember having $13 in my pocket, because there was the leftovers from the money for the passage that my aunt sent me. So I treasured those $13 like if they were $1 million, because that's all I had in my name. Well, lo and behold, on the ship, on the way over, somehow I lost, excuse me, I lost $10. So I was left with $3. I said, oh my, I cried for 2 days because I lost my $10. But I knew that my sister would be waiting for me in New York, because we had written to each other. And I said, well, hopefully she can buy my passage to Cleveland on the train. And of course she did, and so I still got off the train in Cleveland with $3. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that.
Do you remember the weather during the journey?
The journey? Well, the weather at sea was pretty rough. At sea, we had 4 or 5 days that I got seasick a couple times, and it was pretty treacherous. Have never been on a boat before, you know, on a ship like that. I mean, I was kind of scared, but they assured me that we'd make it. So we didn't make it. When I got here, of course, we got in February in the winter, and the winters here were much colder than what I was used to about, you know. But the weather never really meant much to me. I mean, I kind of conformed with whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
And you told me the ship was directed firstly to Halifax, where most of the people get down.
Yes, that the ship was mainly loaded to the gills for Canada. Most, I would say, 90% of the passengers were headed for Canada. And of course, you know, all young people like myself, and a little older perhaps, but all young people. And so we landed we docked in Halifax, and most of the friends that I made on board just got off in Halifax. And then from there, the following day, they left and came down to New York City, and I was actually by myself on the ship as far as, you know, I didn't know anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my journey to there, to New York.
Yeah. What about New York? Magnificent.
Well,
skyline.
I was a little impressed, you know, as we approached the Statue of Liberty, you know, because, you know, it was world renowned, you know, and of course we went by there and we saw Ellis Island, even though we didn't go through Ellis Island anymore because it was closed.
Mm-hmm.
When it came. Well, it was still in operation until 1954, but not as frequent as it used to be. So when I did see New York, I was kind of aback somewhat, because it was impressive, bigger than life, you know, that I ever knew. And of course, when I got off the ship, it was from there to the train station. That's the only actually New York that I've seen. You know, I saw it later on in life, but not at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I was impressed. You know, I was impressed with its size and the traffic and of course the strange language that I said to myself, I probably never learned. You know, eventually. Mm-hmm.
And what about first periods in Cleveland?
Well, when I first, to be honest with you, I had an aunt and uncle that I used to come to. I got off in the station in Cleveland, and I thought I had never seen them personally. I seen pictures, you know. I said, you know, right there. I said, you know, how am I going to find out who they are? You know. Well, as I got into the waiting area, there I saw this couple, and I spotted them for some reason. I said, they must be it. But I says, you know, I'm not going to go up and say who I am, because what if they are not what I think they are? I said, I'd be embarrassed, you know, because I wouldn't know how to talk. But as I approached them, they saw me, and one thing led to another, and they says, okay, you're this, you're that, yeah, okay. So we, you know,
they spoke Friulano.
Friulano, so, mm-hmm. Yeah, they spoke my language. I was happy, because I says, what if they didn't? So my first impression was, you know, I said, well, they must be rich, because they had a car, you know, they had a 1950 Dodge. I'm gonna forget that. And I was impressed. I mean, you know, I said, boy, I said, life must be pretty good here, you know. But you know, as you find out later on, you know, if you have a job in this country, you can, you know, you can achieve things that you always wanted to by just perseverance and work, you know.
Yeah, you was a boy. You were a boy, something like a child, and this was your family.
It was my family here, mm-hmm. You know, in this country, because I left my family behind. So now they became my closest family that I ever had, and I never knew. Of course, mm-hmm. I had to say, well, I hope I like them, because you know, mm-hmm. you don't know.
So what about the food?
Well, the food wasn't that much different here, because, of course, my aunt cooked the way we are accustomed eating. The English food was a little different to me. It was a little foreign. It started out with, we stopped in New York City with my sister, and she said, would you like a coffee? I said, no, sure, you know. So we stopped, and we got a coffee, and they gave me this big mug, you know, with milk. I said, no, I said, I want coffee. I said, well, that's how we drink coffee here. I wasn't accustomed to that. But, of course, it was, you know, I came accustomed
and
to that.
And with English?
English was tough. English was tough from the simple reason that I, even though I was willing to learn and I was kind of a aggressive type kid, at first I said, you know, I said, I never learned this language. I said, I mean, it's so foreign to me. I there's no way I can learn it. You know, I said that to myself. But in time, you know, as I start hanging around with people on the job or watching TV, you know, you keep hearing the same things over and over and over. Within 6 months, I learned enough to get by. But in the meantime, whenever I would go on the job, you know, when I was working, and sometimes they would leave me by myself doing a chore or something, and people would come by and say something to me, and I wouldn't know what to say, but I wouldn't understand. So I said, I have to learn something to say, I don't understand English. And that was my first word in English was, I don't understand. And for instance, when I went to work, I would catch the bus, you know, to go to. And at first, I would go to the bus stop, and invariably every morning somebody would say, "Nice day today, huh?" And I didn't know what to say. So I says, "You know what? I gotta get smart." Now, when I catch the bus, I'm not gonna stand by the bus stop. I'm gonna stand far away from people so they don't talk to me, you know. And that's how I got around that part of my English language. But within, like I said, within a year, I was able to get by. And then, of course, I took some classes at night.
Oh, did you have classes?
Yes, I went for, I think, a semester at Lincoln High School, high school. They had night classes, and I learned.
Night classes.
Yes. And I've learned the English language somewhat through that, you know, the proper grammar, and then by just, you know, conversing with people.
Mm-hmm. And what about U.S. Army?
Well, the U.S. Army is another story. You know, at the time, as you will know, we had a draft in this country. Everyone from when you were 18 years of age, you had to sign for the draft. But, you know, of course, when you sign for the draft, it's just signing in, but it came time where I was drafted. Now, I was married. I got married in 58, and they draft me sometimes in early. Let me think. My days kind of screw up. Well, subsequently, if I got married, I said, I can't go in the Army now. I said, I just got married. I got a job. I'm going to lose, you know. I used to make good money at the time.
Yeah, this was your
That's
car.
That's my first car, yes.
Yeah.
I had just bought the car, you know, in 1957. It cost me $3,500, never forget that. And so what I did, I said, you know, I got to find a way to delay my induction into the Army. So I found someone through my friends at work that he might be able to defer my time of going in. Well, I says, whatever you can to keep me out for a while. Well, he kept me out for about 6 months, but eventually I had to go in. So at the time, I says, you know, I says, oh, what a waste of time. So I'm going to hate to go and waste my 2 years in the Army where I make, you know, no money, you know, and all that. Well, you know what? I went in. I spent for about 8 months in Kentucky, and then from there went to Kansas. And I said, well, you know what? Maybe something good will come out of this. Maybe while I'm in the... Because at the time, they used to send people to Germany, because we had a lot of GIs in Germany. I said, maybe if they send me to Germany, I'll get to visit my family in Italy, because my family was still back in Italy. Well, the problem is, I guess I was too good of a soldier, so they kept me to train the new recruits coming in. He says, you're not going to Germany because we need you here. I So sometimes it's not good to be good. So I never did go to Germany. I never did get to see my family through the military. So I spent my 2 years in the service, and my wife visited me a few times. I came home a few times. So when it was over with, I came back out. But I says, you know, there's one more thing I get out of the service. I'll probably get my citizenship papers, you know, because I wanted to get that, you know. Mm-hmm. So I applied for it. I was in Kansas City, and they told me, says, well, he says, you know, you can't get it through the Army. You have to apply for like anybody else. Yeah, but he says, doesn't being in the Army mean anything? You know.
Mm. Says, it's not enough.
No, not enough. He says, if it was in wartime, then we would automatically give you a citizenship paper. Otherwise, no. So I came home, and a year later or so, I applied, and I finally
This is your document.
And that's my document, the citizenship paper.
1963.
Yeah, this is a paper that's like a Bible to me, because you know whenever I visited my family in Canada at the border, they would say
at that moment your family was moved from.
Yes, by the time I came out of the service, my family had moved to Canada. They immigrated to Canada.
Toronto.
In Toronto, Canada. Right. So whenever I went across the border, if they would ask you. Where were you born? See, it depends on the question they ask you. The minute I would say Canada, they would say, well, you have documents. So this will be my document. I show this, and this was like a passport to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is something that it's, well, next to the passport is the most important paper you have, or that I have. And so I was kind of proud to have that, you know, because it says now I'm a full-fledged citizen. You know, I can do whatever everybody else does. Mm-hmm. Before that, going back a couple of years, if you don't mind me saying this, I had a job before I joined the OA Bertin Company. I had a job with my first employer, and they had a job outside of Cleveland to where they would do government work. So I met the man there that was going to take me into this place to work, and he had to fill in a questionnaire, you know. Mm-hmm. And my questionnaire was, where were you born? And you're an American citizen. I said, no, because I wasn't. I couldn't work. I could not get in there. So I said, oh, boy. So I spent a half a day getting there with a bus. So I spent the other half a day coming home without working because I was not a citizen. So there is an advantage being a citizen in this country as well as probably anywhere else. You know?
Mm-hmm. And what about your family? This is the photograph of your wedding.
Yes, that was my wedding in 1958. I met my wife at a picnic. You know, it was they had a club here called the North Italian Picnic, and I happened to be there. I was, of course, a young man, and I was playing mora. If you know what mora is, you know, we play with your fingers, yeah. You know. And somehow she noticed me, and we got to talk, and she introduced herself, and I work with your father. I said, oh, okay. So, well, from then on, we, you know, developed our relationship, and a couple of years later, we married. Hmm. And we married, let's see, 58.
American style.
Of course. American style, yes. You know, as a matter of fact, a lot of people as guests, we had a whole house full of people. Of course, by that time, my family, now let me see, my brother was here, but I don't think my mother was here yet. My brother and my sister Edda were in Canada. They came before my mother and the rest of my family. Hmm. So they attended my brother was just here a year or so in Canada. So they came down from Canada to be at my wedding. And I remember at the time it was a big wedding, you know. And of course, my father-in-law was a big part of buying the wedding. It actually didn't cost me much because he paid for the whole thing, mm-hmm. You know. He was a very generous person, you know, so I'd say that for him. Mm-hmm. and of course, you know, right after that, after we got married, I was confronted with the 2 years of service, you know, in the military. And that's why we didn't have, I think that's something to do with it. My first child was, we were married for 4 years before my first child came on board, Mark. Hmm. So, yeah, while I was in service, my wife had a job. She worked at a bank, you know, and when we came out, and of course when I came out of the mm-hmm. service, then we started a family, and mm-hmm. we had three kids.
And what about Friulian language? And the first time with the uncle and aunt, you speak it?
Well, of course, when I came over, my dialect, my Friulian dialect was, you know, it was as good as can be. I don't speak the real Friulano. Mm. Our Friulano is kind of a bastardized because we're not from the San Daniele region or Sequoias, but we speak Friulano. And of course, my aunt and uncle, they spoke Friulano. And I find myself very at ease with them to speak, you know, to communicate. But in those days, my Italian was good also. Mm-hmm. It's kind of rusty now, but it was good then. But they were probably more comfortable speaking Friulano with me than Italian, because they were more well versed in it, because they spoke mm-hmm. each other in Friulano, you know. So there was no problem with me doing that, you know. Mm-hmm.
and the relationship with the association, like Italian, Northern Italy?
You know what? I never really. I did attend some of their functions with the North Italian Club, where most of the Friulanos belong to. But, you know, believe it or not, I never became a full-fledged member of the association, even though I participated in a lot of things, and I visited their club, you know, their house where they had the bar and stuff. We played Mora and Bocce and stuff like yeah. that. But I did that while I was single, but after I got married, I kind of broke away from it. You know, so we moved away from the old neighborhood, and I kind of people kind of they got older and they kind of dissociated themselves somewhat. You know, we didn't have that the closeness anymore.
And what did you say about the Friulan way of life in your activity, your family?
I mean, in America or in Friuli?
Yeah, here.
Well, I don't think I kind of adjusted well to the American life, because being young, you get well adjusted to it. And of course, as a young boy, I kind of mixed with the young American kids, so it was easier for me to blend, you know, mm-hmm. to blend in with them. And then of course marriage, you know, then helped, because you know then my wife, you know. My wife, she's a person that she's well versed, even though she doesn't show it. You know, she's a well rounded person. Here an example, when it comes to food, you know, being where I came from, I was exposed to not too many varieties of foods, because you know we kind of limited what we had. So when I came here, I didn't like a lot of things, because you know they were foreign to me. I never ate them before, and she would insist that I eat it. Many times I would get mad. She said, "Don't make me eat something that I don't like." Well, you know what? In retrospect, now I'm glad that she did that, because now I can eat anything. I really do. And you know what? I kind of get not offended, but I get kind of angry at people that don't like food. I says, "How can you not like this or that?" And they would say, "Well, I never tasted it." Well, how can you say you don't like it if you never tasted it? And I remember that was my thing in those mm-hmm. years, but my wife made me do it. She insisted, "You can't say you don't like it unless you taste it."